The rest of this sixth chapter includes several very famous verses, very important verses. So we're, in effect, we're coming to the climax of the Upanishad. Some very important statements. Text number 7. Tam Ishwaranam Paramam Maheshwaram Tam Devatanam Paramam Cha Daivatam Patim Patinam Paramam Parastat Vidama Devam Bhuvanesham Igyam. We know the effulgent Lord, the most worshipable master of the universe. He is the first of all controlling lords, the personality of Godhead. He is the first god among the demigods. He is the master of all masters and the greatest of the great. Here, in the plural, it says we know. So here, the collective experience of self-realized devotees is being cited here as evidence of the Supreme Person's greatness. And the Supreme is here being very much described as a person in comparison to other persons who are great. The demigods are persons. Common people who have personal desires consider it desirable to worship different demigods for the fulfillment of their own desires. Just like even in less civilized cultures like our own, everybody worships some sort of hero. Politicians or movie stars or athletes. There's always some personal role model to be emulated. When there isn't, that's a sign that culture is completely disintegrated, that the culture is finished and about to be replaced with something new, where there's not even any heroes to follow. In Vedic culture, the natural heroes for the common people are the demigods. Everybody, every shopkeeper has got his little Murti next to the cash register and worships his favorite deity. Every bus, every truck has its own chosen deity on the dashboard or on top of the truck. Of all the deities on everybody's dashboard, he's the supreme deity. So he's being compared now as a person, compared to other people. Everyone has their heroes. Everyone's got his favorite demigod. He's the greatest of all the gods. Patim patinam. Everybody's serving some master. The wife is serving the husband. The children are serving the teacher and the parents. The husband is serving someone who pays his paycheck, and so on. Everybody's serving the government. But he, there's a whole chain, a whole hierarchy, complex hierarchy in the material world of rulers. He's the supreme ruler, supreme master of all masters. Trace this line of hierarchy. The child is subordinate to the mother. The mother is subordinate to the husband. The husband's subordinate to his employer and to the government, and so on. The government is subordinate to the demigods. The demigods are subordinate to the Supreme Lord. Therefore, Paramam Parastat, he's greater than the greatest, than anyone else who can be qualified as great, because he's Bhuvanesham. He's the controller of the whole universe, Jagannath. Therefore, he's supremely worshipable, Idyam. That's our realization of him. This is personal realization. This is not just metaphysics. Yes, God is the creator, but he's among all very attractive persons who have to be feared and revered. He's the most deserving, the most demanding of our reverence. He's the supreme among all worshipable deities like Indra. People in general worship Indra and other demigods to fulfill their desires. But who is it that Indra and the other demigods are worshipping? That's Lord Vishnu, the supreme person. Paramam Parastat, he's greater than the greatest. Materialists think that the greatest power in the world is material nature and the laws of nature. But he's beyond that. He controls nature. We know him. We have realized, the sages are saying here, or Shvetashvatar is saying on behalf of himself and his predecessors, his teachers, the other sages that came before him, that he's telling the new sages, who he's training up, I and my predecessors, we know him. We have directly realized him personally. He's a person, and we as persons have realized our relationship with him. And thus we have taken shelter of him. Okay, we'll go to the next verse. That goes, Prabhupada usually quotes these two verses together, 7 and 8. In the Bhagavad Gita, they're quoted elsewhere too. Natasya karyam karanam cha vidyate natatsamascha vyadikascha drishyate parasya shaktir vividaiva shruyate svabhaviki jnana balakriya cha. He has no obligations to work and no material senses for carrying out work. No one can be found equal to him or greater than him. His own superior energy has manifold aspects. As we hear from scripture, she acts autonomously in her functions of knowledge, power, and movement. He has no obligations. He doesn't come to this world and do things because he has to. He's not impelled by material desire. No one else is forcing him to do anything. Whatever he does is his own sport, his own free will. And in any case, he doesn't have a material body or material senses to act on the karmic level. But he has his transcendental body and senses that are inseparable aspects of his essential self. They're a part of his swarup, his body and his senses. Without any material body and senses, how does he act in the material world? How does he help create and maintain the material world? Parasha Shaktir. He has his Parashakti, his superior energy. He has his superior energy and his inferior energy, which expands from his superior energy. His original energy is his spiritual, personal energy. And from his personal energy expands Maya. She's the expansion of his internal energy. Those two aspects of his energy do everything for him. And it said Swabhaviki. She's acting autonomously. That means, just like the living entity has his own consciousness, his own will, free will, when the living entity chooses voluntarily to serve the Supreme, he's properly properly using his autonomy. And he can misuse his autonomy and fall into illusion. That says he's autonomous. His personal energy, his internal and external aspects of his personal energy are also autonomous, but they never rebel. That's his internal, that's his personal energy. Autonomy is there, though. Otherwise, what's the difference between the Lord doing it himself and his energy doing it if the energy is nothing but an extension, a direct extension with no autonomy? But Maya and his internal energy have their own consciousness, their own desire, but their desire is to serve him, simply. So he can avoid the anxiety of creating and maintaining by passing that, delegating that responsibility to his energies. And they can do the worrying for him and the working for him. It's not just Shvetashvatara Rishi's personal opinion. He's saying, Shriyate, this is all corroborated, backed up by the statements of scripture. I'm not just saying this out of my own head, Shvetashvatara says. But the Lord, the Supreme Person, is described in many places in the Shruti, in the Upanishads and Vedas, as having his energies, even when he's described negatively. That is a description of his energies, of his personal qualities. Even when the good said God is invisible. To be invisible, you must have some power to prevent people from seeing you. Just like they built this stealth bomber airplane. Nobody can see, you know, you can't see it with radar. They spent billions of dollars and a lot of energy expended and thought given how to make this airplane invisible. God makes himself invisible. That's an expression of his power, that he can make himself invisible. It's not that he's nothing because he's invisible, or that he has no energy because he's invisible. Or any negative thing you say about God, he's not this, he's not that, that's an expression of his glories, of his power. That's more proof that he has his potencies, that manifest in positive and negative ways. These energies are also called swabhaviki in the sense that they're natural. Just like fire has naturally its power of heat, the Lord naturally has his creative powers. They don't have to be given to him by somebody else. Lord Vishnu didn't have to please some demigod to get his weapons or his powers. They're naturally part of his personality. So, in the very beginning of the Govinda Bhashya, the commentary to the first sutra, Baladeva Vidyabhushan has a short comment that we can understand the Lord has his personal qualities of knowledge and so on, and that these qualities are eternal from statements of the scripture, especially Shvetashvatara Upanishad establishes that the Lord has his eternal qualities of knowledge and so on. As stated, Parasa Shakti Vividaya Vishriyate. So Bhaviki Gyana Bala Kriyacha. Baladeva Vidyabhushan was quoting this verse. That the Lord has his variegated superior energy, as we hear from scripture. That energy acts autonomously. It's natural also. It's innate to him. And it manifests in the different aspects of knowledge, power, and movement. Those three aspects are also known as Samvit, Sandhati, and Vladati. The power, Samvit is the consciousness energy of the Lord, which manifests in the spiritual and material world. Sandhati is the existence power, all the worlds, through the agency of Lord Baladeva, are manifest as expression of the Sandhati Shakti. Everything that exists in the spiritual and material world. And then Hladi Shakti is the pleasure potency. Activity, originally in the spiritual condition, is an expression of ecstasy. Just like a person who is ecstatic dances and sings naturally as an expression of his ecstasy. He just can't sit there and do nothing. He has to sing and dance because he's ecstatic. That's the natural, original form of movement. Katagana Natyam Gamanamati. In Svetadvipa, in Goloka Vrindavan, all the talking is singing, all the walking is dancing. All movement originally is simply an expression of ecstasy. And then it becomes perverted. Now in the material world, the man who has to work in a factory has to, you know, pull a lever on a machine 40,000 times a day. That's what his ecstatic movement has turned into, a perverted form. But the origin is the same. This Hladni Shakti, pleasure potency, is the origin of all movement. Just like the temple president asks the head cook, "Oh, please go cook the Sunday feast." And the cook knows what to do. He knows where to get the ingredients. If he doesn't have enough ingredients, he knows where to get some money to buy some more. And he knows what to do with the ingredients. The Hemp President simply delegates to him, okay, you know, it's your job to make cook the feast. And it's understood. He has the power. The cook has the power to do what's necessary. And he has the knowledge to do it properly. That's his autonomy. He knows himself what to do. He has the power to go and get some money. Under the authority of being the cook, he can take money from the treasury and go to the market and buy more, and so on. That's his autonomy. His relative independence under authority to do something. It manifests in his knowledge and his ability to do things. So Prakriti, nature, is autonomous. Her energies are autonomous. And the living entities are also autonomous. The difference with the living entities is that their autonomy is conditional. They have to choose to use it right. If they misuse it, they're in trouble. The personal energies of the Lord don't have the same dangerous situation. The internal potency, even the external potency of the Lord, Maya, cannot fall down. Maya can't fall into Maya. She's naturally inclined always to serve the Lord. But that's her, she's exercising her autonomy that way. She doesn't have the freedom to fall down, but she has the freedom to express herself according to her own capacity in serving the Lord. The jiva has got an extra capacity, the capacity to fall down. Durga is not a jiva yet. Durga is an expansion of Krishna's pleasure potency, but the material expansion of in the energy, in the category called Shakti Tattva, not Jiva Tattva. Because the Jivas are small, whereas the Shakti Tattva is infinite, as the Lord is. It's the female counterpart of the Lord. But just like Lord Shiva is equivalent to Lord Vishnu, but he's transformed. Just like milk is turned into yogurt, and he can't turn the yogurt back into milk again. Lord Shiva is a transformation of Lord Vishnu. He's not a small spark like the jiva. He's complete. He's infinite. But he's changed. He's now fermented. And he makes contact, he associates with the material energy, who is the fermented aspect of the Lord's pleasure potency. Okay. But she's infinite, just as Lord Shiva is infinite. No, Ogana Pala.
The two other ones seem to be with Sandhin and Sandhin.
Yes, power goes with creation of things. That's Sandhini Shakti, the existence potency. That power which creates the various existences, like the spiritual world itself, and all the things in the spiritual world, and the material world, all the things in the material world, are created by the Sandhini Shakti, the second one. The third one, Kriyasha, the Shakti, I'm looking up with Kriya, with activity, movement. The pleasure potency is manifests activity or movement.
Are you reading that in the last line of the page?
Oh, Icha Shakti, Jnana Shakti, Kriya Shakti, Na.
Yeah. Willpower, power of knowledge, which is something.
Yes.
Creative energy, which is the something. So I understand that willpower is loving. Or,
Well, that's a different interpretation. But it is, because it is Krishna's Kaviraj's interpretation, we have to take it seriously.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's enough.
Oh, no, okay. No. And he gives, if you read, that's only the first verse of a long passage, he explains everything in detail throughout the next whole page.
That's all.
Yeah. Anyway, whatever he says, we accept. without conditions. Okay, we can move on to verse 9 right now. Natasya kaschid patir asti loke na cheshita naiva chatasya lingam sakaranam karanadi paripo natasya kaschid janitana chadipaha. No one in this world is his master or controller, and there is no evidence to prove his existence by mere logic. He is the supreme cause, the ruler of the rulers of the senses. The demigods are the rulers. He's the ruler of the demigods. No one is his progenitor or ruler. So for all these reasons, he has no master in this world. No one can control him. Nor can he be known just by logic. What to speak of direct perception? No ordinary person can see him. And no philosopher can simply, by speculation, by deduction, know him. Because there is no linga. In this sense, it means a logical symptom. If I look on the mountain and I see smoke coming from the mountain, I can deduce there must be some fire on the mountain. Wherever I've seen smoke, I always saw there was always some fire there. Like when I see smoke in the kitchen, it's because there's a fire in the kitchen. So here's smoke on top of the mountain, there must be some fire there, although I can't see the fire now. That's logic. But there is no such logic to establish the nature of God, or even to prove his existence. That's the importance of scripture. Either God has to show himself to you personally, or you have to meet somebody who has seen God, who you can trust the opinion of, or you have to listen to the scripture, which is the recorded evidence of those who have seen God, and sometimes spoken by God himself. And actually, we need to rely on all three. Guru, Shadow, and Shastra. Most of us have not met God directly, but we're very fortunate if we've met a representative of God who knows God directly. And if we can live in the association of those who serve such persons and study the scriptures, then our life is successful. Because there's no other way to know God. That's one reason why God appears in this world periodically, why there are avatars. He has his personal reasons, but one reason why he does it for our benefit is that if he didn't reveal himself, if he didn't show people what he's actually like, all the great thinkers would simply have to speculate about him and guess, make all sorts of strange guesses, because they would have no solid evidence. To give them something solid to go by in their investigations, he comes and shows himself. Here I am, this is what I actually am. Because there's no material sign, no logical symptom by which any philosopher can deduce the existence of God. He has to show himself, otherwise he can't be known. Well, all those arguments are faulty. We could try to convince someone on that basis, but logically it's not a proof. We can't convince anyone to become a devotee on the basis of logic. We have to appeal to their heart. Mm-hmm. And sometimes we just have to stop them with prasadam. Mm-hmm. Yeah. We use logic. We use logic. It's a tool for convincing someone, but ultimately it's not in itself convincing. A person will accept a logic if he wants to. If he wants to accept the personality of God, and if he's ready to in his heart, then the logic will help. But it doesn't prove. There's no mathematical proof that Krishna is the Supreme Lord. Why Krishna? Why not somebody else? Even if you accept that there's a God, why is it Krishna? And a lot of theists, even a lot of Vaishnavas, have difficulty with Krishna. Even the Vaishnavas who have to accept that Krishna is one of the major avatars of Vishnu because he's glorified in every Purana. And he has so many temples and so many devotees. So the other Vaishnavas have to accept Krishna, but they're sometimes embarrassed by him. You know, he's engaged in all sorts of illicit activities. So they have him on the altar and so many pictures glorifying him, but they're shy to actually be full-fledged devotees of Krishna. They'd rather worship Narayana or Lord Ramachandra, who behave more properly. So even the Vaishnavas have a difficulty simply accepting Krishna as the Supreme God. That even the logic of the Vedas, even the statements of the Upanishads and the Puranas themselves won't prove it to anybody logically. There has to be a proper disposition of the heart to accept. One has to get the mercy of someone who is a devotee of Krishna in order to appreciate Krishna. That's the only way. Okay. There's an argument here for the Vedanta Sutra. Okay. A doubt is raised, Baladeva Vibhushan says. It's not possible, someone may say, that Brahman is the doer, the creator, or that he does anything else, because he doesn't have any senses. The demigods, who have their potency to create and maintain, they have senses. They have material bodies and senses. And this way they're able to carry out their responsibilities. But the Absolute Truth doesn't have any senses. How can he be the creator of the universe? How can he act? And scriptures like the Shvetashvatara Upanishad, the objectors are now quoting, say that he doesn't have any senses. This is established by Upanishadic authority. Apanipado Jivano Grihita. He has no hands and no legs, and still he takes everything that he wants. He sees without eyes. Pashat Yachakshu Sashrinot Akarnala. He sees without eyes, he hears without ears. But that's saying, he doesn't have any hands, any legs, any ears, any eyes. So, how do you explain that, they ask? How can he be the doer? Well, what you're saying, that because the Lord, Baladeva Vibhushan answering, you're saying that the Lord, because he has no senses, can't be a doer. But that's all explained later on in the Shvetashvatara Upanishad, where it's said that he has his personal superior energy, which acts autonomously on his behalf. It's all reconciled by that statement. And thus it's said, he's the supreme Tamishwaranam Paramamaheshwaram. He's the supreme demigod of all demigods, the supreme lord of all lords, supreme master of all masters, greater than the greatest. We know him, the worshipable lord of the universe. He doesn't have any, and so on, these two verses. He doesn't have any body or any senses, any obligation to carry out. No one is equal to him or greater than him, but he has his superior energy, which manifests in many ways, is so described in scripture, and is autonomous in the aspects of jnana, bala, and kriya, knowledge, power, and activity. And then again it said, in the verse we just read, no one in this world is his master or his controller, and there is no evidence to prove his existence by mere logic. He is the supreme cause, the ruler of the ruler of the senses. No one is his progenitor or ruler. So Baladeva Vibhushan just quoted these three verses in a row. And he says, thus, when it was said earlier in the Shvetashvatara Upanishad that he had no hands and no legs, that was not actually, literally contradicting or denying that he has any hands or legs. Because it says right there in the same line, that without any hands or legs, he manages to take whatever he wants. And he sees, even though he doesn't have eyes, and he hears, even though he doesn't have ears. So what is rather being said is that his sensory functions are not limited to particular senses. Sarvatak Pani Padam Tam. His hands and legs are everywhere, meaning that they do everything. He can see with his ears, hear with his eyes, and so on. As stated, also in the Brahma Samhita, Angani Yasya Sakalendriya Vrittimanti, every one of his limbs performs the functions of all senses. That's what it means he doesn't have any ordinary hands and legs, or he's not restricted to walk only with his hands, or to walk only with his feet, or see only with his eyes. Okay. I will read verse 10 now. Yas tantunaba eva tantubi padana jayak swabhavataha deva ekak samavridoti sano tadyad mamapyayam. Like a spider weaving the threads of its web, he causes this world to naturally evolve from material nature. He alone covers everything with his energies. May that effulgent Lord grant us transcendental union with himself. Here the sage, Shretashvatara, is praying for liberation, for himself and for everybody else involved, for his students also. Apyaya means union or merging, but we understand what he means by merging with the Supreme. Devotional union, not impersonal. The Lord, this is the famous example of a spider which weaves its web and out of its own body. And then spiders web is a very complex creation. If you've ever seen a spider weaving its web, very fantastic feat of engineering. And then after a while it decides to pull the web back within itself. Like that, the Supreme supplies its own ingredients, his own ingredients for creating this world. Plays with it for some time. Keeps the living entities entrapped in Maya as the spider traps other insects in its web. Plays with them and then devours them. Similarly, the Supreme Lord, when he's had enough of the universe, when its duration is finished, he winds up everything, including living entities, back within himself, like a spider. The strings of this web, the web of material illusion, are born out of pradana jai, the modes of nature, and various material things that are created as permutations of the modes of nature all come from pradana, the original form of nature. And they evolve naturally. One way of understanding naturally is that word autonomously. The energies of the Lord are simply told by the Lord what to do, and they know what to do. They act on his behalf without his having to interfere any further. He's allowed to put aside the business of creation and let his energies act for him. That is Svabhavata. From our point of view, it looks like everything is impersonal, from the material point of view. But we don't understand that the Supreme Lord has set this all into motion by his intelligence and his desire, that he expressed by simply glancing at material nature once. That is the real expert cook. He doesn't even have to be told, cook the Sunday feast. The temple peasant just gives him a glance and he knows, okay, it's time to cook the feast. The Supreme Lord alone envelops everything. He covers everything. He pervades everything. So who are you going to go to ask for freedom from your entanglement? He alone. Don't go to Durga. Don't go to anybody else, any demigod. Only that Supreme Person. Even though here we don't express his name. Perhaps Shvetashvara Rishi doesn't know who, although he's strongly hinting that this is a person, the greatest, greater than all the demigods, master of all masters. That sounds like a person. But this person's name, his identity, he's not saying. Maybe he doesn't know, or at least he's not saying. But whoever he is, Sa, may that person, whoever he may be, bestow upon us transcendental union with himself. Okay, I'll read another verse. Yes, some places it does. There are other Upanishads that are much more explicit. There are Upanishads dedicated to different expansions of Lord Vishnu. There's the Gopal Tapati Upanishad, Mahanarayan Upanishad, Nrsingha Tapati Upanishad, and they're describing vividly the personal features of the Lord and his bodily features and so on. So they go, not only in the Bhagavatam, but even in some of the Upanishads, these are described. And even here, Shaitanya Upanishad, even though he's called Rudra and not Krishna here, there's a description of his face, of his compassionate face. There's hints of his personal bodily features. Yeah, they're not prepared. They're not prepared. They're not inclined to meditate on the personal bodily features of the Lord. Not that they're ignorant and such. These sages probably, in South India nowadays, at least, if not in the north, in South India there's a temple of some form of Vishnu on every block, in every city, in every village. You can't go 100 yards without finding a temple of some avatar, or some demigod at least. So what to speak of these past ages, when there was more Vedic culture, certainly the Vedic sages were not ignorant of the fact that the forms of Vishnu and the demigods are being worshipped in temples all over. But they're thinking, this is for the common people. They personify the Supreme because they can't understand it impersonally. And it was just, they read in the Upanishads and they see the deities, they see everybody worshipping different gods. And they think this is just common, this is just naive. It's just conceive of the Supreme as a person. As long as they're not envious, then they're such gyanis are savable. If they don't have an envious attitude toward God. The Mayavadis are trying to annihilate God's personality. The other personalists who are simply themselves naive, although they think the other people are naive, they're not envious, but they just don't have a taste for the personality of God. They're not trying to destroy God, they just leave God alone. Just like among primitive people, it's very common that they worship different demigods, forces of nature. They worship all sorts of spirits and ghosts and mountains and trees. They worship the lightning and the sun and the moon. Tribal people. But anthropologists are discovering, when you ask these people, do you believe that there's a supreme person, a supreme God? They say, of course. He created this world. But he's very terrible. So we prefer not to have anything to do with him. He leaves us alone, we leave him alone. But we worship all these spirits instead. So it's like these sages are like that. They're actually very primitive spiritually themselves. They know that God is there, but they don't hate him, but they don't like to deal with him too much. They leave him alone, he leaves them alone. Whereas the Mayavadis are actually envious, and they're condemned. This is verse 11 we're going to read, another very famous verse. Eko devatsava bhuteshu gunaha sava vyapi sava bhutantaratma karma dhyakshat sava bhutarivasa sakshi cheta kevalo nirgunascha. The one Supreme Lord is hidden in the heart of all creatures, pervading everywhere. He lives within all, as the soul of souls, superintending the action of karma. He is the companion friend of all living beings. their witness and the inspirer of their consciousness. But he is aloof from material existence and has no material qualities. Although the super soul is in everybody's heart, he's not seen. Generally, he's invisible. That's his prerogative. He doesn't want to show himself, then by the exertion of his power, he becomes invisible. He's not only in every soul, in every heart, he's not only accompanying the jiva, but he's everywhere. Not only every person, but everything is pervaded by him. So, maybe question, if he's all-pervading, how can anybody realize him? You can't see something that has no limits, that has no shape, because it has no edge, it has no boundary. You can't see the sky, because it's all expanding. It has no, there's no side, no front, no back, no beginning, no end of the sky. And so nobody can see it. How can you see the Supreme then? He has no boundaries. I can see the table, because here's the top. I recognize that's the top of the table. Here's the side. There's the back, the front. I can see the limits, the boundaries of the table, and therefore I recognize the table. But if this table was infinite in size, I would never be able to see it. I'd never be able to find its front, its top, its back. How can you see the Supreme then? He's all-pervading. He has no boundaries. Because he's, beside being all-pervading, he's localized. He's the personal controller of every person sitting inside everybody's heart. You can find his limit. He chooses to limit himself to the size of a thumb, to the size of the heart, by his inconceivable potency. At the same time as being everywhere, he's in a particular place at a particular size. That's the combination of contradictory qualities that's expressed in the second line. Sarva-vyapi, he's pervading everywhere, and he's localized sarva-bhutantaratma in every person's heart at the same time. Karmadyaksha, he's the inspirer and the regulator of all pious and impious activities. Whatever anybody does is under his control. Nothing happens that's not regulated by him. So there is no chaos, there's no chance, and there's nothing that doesn't, that isn't sanctioned by the Supreme Lord, that doesn't happen because he wants to let it happen. So a devotee should not be in anxiety. Anxiety is not, as Bhais Prabhupada explained, not understanding that the Supreme Person is absolutely in control of everything. Only because we don't fully realize that do we ever feel anxiety. Tatra kamoha kakshoka atmanamanupashyata. One who sees the presence of the super soul everywhere, what reason does that person have for being confused or unhappy in any situation? He doesn't have any reason. And he's the sakshi. He's living in everybody's heart, and he's sakshi. That means the witness. He sees everything that happens to us and everything we do. So we can't cheat him. We can't do anything that we think he might not see. Even if no one else sees, he sees. There's the American dollar bill, there's an esoteric emblem on the backside. This pyramid with an eye on top. The founders of the American state, some of them were Rosicrucians and Masons, and so this is an esoteric Rosicrucian symbol. And it comes from a parable taught by Jesus in the Bible of the Pyramid of Giza, I think is the name, I don't know if you know this story. Anyway, in the desert, just Egyptian Masons were building a pyramid, and they had to pull these very large stones up the pyramid to construct it. And the higher up they got, the harder it was to pull each level, new level of stones up to near the top. When they got to the very top, the last stone was the hardest one to pull. They had to pull the furthest. And they said among themselves, who's going to see this stone on the top anyway, so let's just forget it. And they left out the last stone. Nobody saw it, but the motto of the story is that God saw it. And they were cursed for violating their duty because God saw it. And you see the picture in the back of the dollar bill, this pyramid with an eye on top. That's the eye of God. So if nobody else could see, he sees everything. And Chaita, he's the giver of consciousness. Of course, we always have consciousness, but that consciousness is in various states. Sometimes it's not functioning very well. We get our proper consciousness. Our consciousness functions properly when we're properly linked up with the Supreme. A pure devotee, one who is properly connected with Krishna, or in some form of Krishna, he's in proper consciousness. He can think properly, he's satisfied, he's free from confusion, and he knows everything clearly. Because the Lord, in that personal relationship, supplies him with all the proper functioning of consciousness. We don't know what healthy consciousness is like. We have not experienced it. At the same time, he's aloof. He's not involved in any material way. He's not reciprocating with us because he's trying to get something from us, exploit us, or make a profit from us, or misuse us. And he's not at all touched in any way by the material qualities. Okay, I've got two more verses here. Or we'll just do one more verse today.
Eko vashi diskriyanam bahunam ekam bijam bahuda yakkaroti tamatmastam yedu pashyanti diras tesham sukam shashvatam netaresham.
He is the one controller of those who have no material engagement. The one seed who acts in many forms. Thoughtful persons who appropriately perceive him in their own hearts can achieve perpetual happiness, which is not available for others. So the Lord has his relationship with everything and everybody. He's maintaining everybody's life. The very necessities of life are all being provided for him, by him. The air we breathe, the light to see with, the food we eat, are all supplied by him. And he supplies them even to those who want to ignore him and those who want to be his enemies. That he supplies for everybody. But he has special relationships with those who are nishkriya, who have stopped trying to exploit material nature. Not just impersonalists who are trying to negate everything, but especially devotees, who have stopped trying to enjoy nature and instead want to be surrendered devotees. With those people, he reciprocates in a special way. Eko Vashi, he's the one controller of his devotees who have given up all material engagements. Those devotees who constantly meditate on him, anupashyanti, as present in their hearts, they gain the eternal happiness of liberation. Tesham sukham shashvatam. Netaresham. But other people cannot gain this happiness. Other people, as stated in another verse, dukam eva piyanti. They don't get happiness, they just get misery. Okay, the final exam is going to be in two parts. One part is a paper I'm going to sign right now. And the other part will be a short quiz. It shouldn't take more than a half hour on Friday. It'll be a simple quiz. But you can start working now on the paper and you just hand it in when you take the quiz on Friday. The question is, this will take some thinking and maybe some research. Please explain What is the similarity between the Shvetashvatara Upanishad and the Bhagavad Gita? And what are the differences? Whatever you can, you know, whatever ideas you can come up with. This will take some creative thinking and some research. You're free to come up with your own ideas, but try to come up with valid ideas that are actually justified by the two books.
Okay.
That's due class time on Friday, when we'll give.
Okay.
Thank you all. Glorious Srila Prabhupada.